is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network. The views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. Now here's your host for Sunday Drive, Daryl Power.
Come all you good people, I'll sing you a song about the poor people, how they get along. Good afternoon to everybody out there in Radio Land, right across the island portion of this province and up there in the big land of Labrador. I have a friend on the other side of the glass who has been taking care of me for, I don't know, some 6 months. And he always was a buddy. But I can tell you right now, that guy is my buddy. Zach Snow is on the other side of the glass.
He's some fella.
Today, a band. Imagine a band staying together for 25 years. I can't imagine because actually I haven't done it.
you tried your best.
I made it to 10, toss into Rankin Street and got 15, right? But 25. Mark Hiscock is here in the studio and we're going to talk about what a wonderful career that Shani Gannock has had 25 years, Mark. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's been a great 25, I guarantee you. As Chris said, now the next 25 will be just as good.
Yeah, I can
year see. 26, we're out.
You guys need an oxygen sponsor.
Yeah, pretty much these days. Yeah, actually, I'm trying to get a bit healthier, so my oxygen levels are a little bit better these days on stage. But yeah, it's you know, we're a driving band. You know, you're when I'm up there, you know, driving the accordion and stuff, takes a bit of energy, especially now at 47 years old, and you know the fingers are still loose though. There's no arthritis in them yet. They're still going good.
Mark, your fingers are still perfect. Every time I hear a tune, I don't hear a bad note.
See that after 44 years of playing, I've made a career of correcting my notes without anybody hearing me. I'm good at covering them up.
It's a trick.
It's a trick. It's a good trick.
The best. Advice I've ever heard, if you make a mistake, make it again the second time and it becomes a part.
It becomes part of it, yeah, that's right.
Let's go back to Rogers Television.
Ooh, right back to what, 1986, I think it was.
How old were you?
I was 8 years old when I started. The first show that I was on with Channel 9 was Cable Atlantic, Cable 9 back then, was a show called Harris and Harris Jamboree.
Herman
and Christine Harris from out in Harbor Grace.
Don't even remotely remember that.
Billy Sutton used to be on that one too, right?
Oh my God, how old was Billy?
I don't know, he was probably around the same age, I suppose, but...
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. If anyone has footage of Billy Sutton playing on Harrison Harris, I really would love it. Send it to Daryl Power NL on Twitter
right.
Or Daryl Power Facebook, please.
Yeah. I'm sure it was good. Even back then, you know, Billy's always been a great player and great singer. Yeah, so the Harrison Harris was the first one, and then I started up on Eyes Dubai.
Which was, I mean, like that show really... caught a lot of people. Everybody watched that show.
Well, it was aired, I think, maybe it was definitely twice, maybe three times a week, and it came on at, I think, around 11:30 in the morning when you were cooking Jig's dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So people would, you know, they'd had their potatoes on, go in, sit down, watch Eyes Dubai for half an hour, and then potatoes were done. Right?
How did they find you, Mark?
My cousin, who lives next door to me out in Fort Amherst, his brother-in-law worked with Joe Reynolds, who was the bus, he drove Metrobus, and he put me in contact with Joe, and went in and, you know, jammed out with the boys at Randy Dyke's house there a couple of times, and went in, done the first show, and the boys said they got a lot of demand and a lot of requests for me to come back, and I was back and forth then on the show for another 8 years.
But you were just a kid.
Yeah, just as Randy used to say, you were a bump on a log. He said, now you're a log. But I was only 8 years old, and I probably never started singing with the accordion until I was probably around six, maybe even seven, when I was actually singing and playing the accordion. I started playing the accordion when I was four, And I actually made an appearance on Skipper and Company when I was five in kindergarten.
Playing the accordion?
Playing the accordion, yeah. With St. Mary's Elementary. We went as the choir, and the principal said, bring your accordion with you.
You got to meet Corky.
I got to meet Corky and became really good friends with Corky's son. And myself and Peter Barefoot was one of my first duos was with Peter, with Corky's young fella.
I'm friends with Corky's son, too.
Yeah, Pete's a great guy.
But I remember, this is like totally off topic, but hell, we're doing talk radio. Right. Dad took me down to Dick Nolan's house.
Oh, cool.
Because Dick lived in Albuquerque for a long while.
Oh, okay, cool.
And I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I walked into the living room, and Corky was sitting on the couch.
Right.
And I was like, hello, like, you know, Bono, Prince.
Right, Newfoundland style.
Like, star sighting. Yeah. I just couldn't believe I was in the room with Corky.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah, Max is a great guy, and Peter and his young fellow Chris too, great guys, good, nice family.
A nice family.
Yep.
Nice people.
Yep.
So, the story is a great story.
It is.
Ralph.
Ralph, yeah.
Our buddy.
Good buddy, good pal.
Oh, Ralph. I'm going to send out a bouquet to Ralph right now.
Good guy.
He is a good guy.
Talking to Ralph the other night at the at our 25th anniversary concert at Holy Heart.
He did a lot for traditional music in this province.
Ralph played a massive role. You know, when the Sons of Erin were very popular, and when he opened up Erin's Pub, it started off a lot of careers. You know, the Irish Descendants. You know, yourselves and myself and Chris and so many, Connemara, so many local acts, you know, got their start on that stage when, Ralph had the open mic nights on the Wednesday night. So there was a lineup down to the TD Bank to get in there on a Wednesday night.
Dave Benson.
Yep. Dave, right? Great guy.
Right?
Yeah.
Ralph said when we were coming off the ferry and we were driving to St. John's for the first time, we thought we were on the moon, sir.
Oh, yeah. I can only imagine, right?
The lush green fields of Ireland to
the rocky shores of Newfoundland.
The isthmus.
Right.
Like, yeah. You know what I mean? That wall.
Yeah, exactly.
So you were double booked.
Yeah, myself and Chris were doing solo acts at the pub on the weekends, and I'd probably do a Friday night, he'd do a Saturday night, or we'd do a weekend or whatever, as solo acts. And yeah, one night I walked in and Chris was setting up his guitar on the stage, and I had my accordion and my guitar, and I was like, this is not right. So anyway, he said, are you booked here tonight? I said, I think so, bye. And he said, geez, I think I am too. So anyway, we went down and sat at the bar, and, Ralph just, he said, well, boys, he said, I'm not going to send both of you home or either of you home. You know, he said, get up and see what happens, check it out. There's extra mics there on stage. And so next thing you know, two of us are on stage, and, Chris grew up listening to the Sons of Erin and Ryan's Fancy and all, the Chieftains and the Dubliners and all that stuff. And I grew up listening to, Dick Nolan and Harry Hibbs. Mm-hmm. And, I also had Ryan's Fancy and Sons albums, but I wasn't into the Irish style as much as I was the Newfoundland country and the Newfoundland music. So, the combination of the accordion and my tenor voice and Chris's, gruff growl voice, and, it was something that matched, and, we ended up, sticking it together and taking the two different styles of music that we knew and made it into what is today Shanniganock.
Shanniganized.
We Shannyized it. Yeah, and that's why I always say, we take certain tunes and, we make it our own. We love taking some of the older songs that haven't been recorded in a long time and keep them as traditional and as close to the original as possible. But we just put our own little twist on it and put our own little arrangement to it, and we make it our own, and it works.
It's been a wonderful little duo.
Oh, absolutely. From when we started as a duo to when we got Byron Pardy with the buddy, what's his name, and the other fella, he plays bass with them, and his brother came with us, Bob. And when myself and Chris originally started, we were calling ourselves Snackpack. And then when Bob came in, he was the side of gravy. That was before the Shanny days.
Byron Pardy, what a bass player.
Yeah, Byron had a stint with us as well, too, right?
He stood behind Buddy Watch's name for, I don't know.
He's there a long time now.
Long time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, great guy, great musician, great engineer, great sound tech. He's all around. He is the guy.
We are talking with Mark Hiscock. This is going to be the first break. It is Shanniganock's 25th anniversary, 25 years without beating the faces of each other.
We've done pretty good. You know, we've had a few rackets, but nothing that you don't get over.
My God. And after the break, we may talk about the rackets. Don't go away.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
86 Galway Boulevard, Chris Batstone. Great bass player.
Oh, man, he's one of the best around. He is a great guy. Great guy. I've known Chris a long time.
Chris, you listening? We're giving you a shout out. So, Mark, 8 years old, 9 years old.
Yep.
Then you meet Chris.
Yep.
And then you decide you're going to put something together.
Yep. We were together as a duo, and we put out an album that Dermot O'Reilly produced down in the basement of his house down in beautiful Torbay.
The first album I made was in that basement.
Yeah, there was a lot of first albums made down in Dermot's basement.
And Dermot was hovering all the time.
Yeah.
And Anne was making tea.
And Anne was making tea and cooking tea buns, yeah.
It God was like, her. Really, like the first original Grape Sea album, we did it in 7 days, I think.
Oh,
mixed
wow.
it in one.
Yeah.
Pat, thank you for mixing it in one.
Yeah.
But we finally had a place where we could record.
Yep. Yeah.
For cheap.
Yeah, that's right. Like Echo and these places were around, but was Echo there when you guys were?
Yeah,
there?
Echo. Yeah. Oh God. Echo.
Now we're going back.
You're going way back now.
We're going
now
back,
Echo.
Right? Yeah.
Sandy Moore, is she listening? Echo, Echo, Echo.
Yeah, but Dermot's Basin was a great spot. We've done the Newfoundland album down there, and I went down after and doing a few tracks for other people.
What was it called?
The original album, but
yeah.
It was called Newfoundland. Mm. All I need is a strong north wind and a fine white ship. And Mikey's song was on it. Skiddly idle doodle idle diddly idle da. Yeah, that was a pretty cool little album that was.
Who played in that?
On that album, Blackie O'Leary played bass.
Are you serious?
Noel Worthman, I believe, played Bowron. Carl
okay.
Peters.
I'm about to fall off my chair.
Carl Peters played guitar and some electric,
like,
and a
mandolin. Three names that I would never have expected, Mark. Like three names I never would have expected.
Of course, myself and Chris. Who else was on that? Somebody played like a keyboard. I can't remember his name right now. He was a friend of Chris's. And there was a couple of other. Ralph O'Brien sang on it. Fergus O'Byrne played on it. And for me and Chris, this was like our first thing that we'd done. And to have all these people come in and be a part of the album with you and sit down and watching people, you know, especially Chris, like idolizing Fergus and Dermot. Here he is in Dermot's basement with Fergus O'Byrne playing on his album.
Don't think.
And Ralph O'Brien singing on it.
Don't think I never realized the importance of being in Dermot's basement.
Oh, you don't know what you never
recording
knew.
That first album.
Yeah, and you didn't know who was going to pop in and who was around, and myself and Chris had a great opportunity there a while ago. Dennis Ryan was mm-hmm. in town, and he was doing a new album, and he asked me and Chris to come down and play on and sing. So here's Dermot, Fergus, Dennis, and myself and Chris in the basement of Dermot's. Doing recording on Dennis's album.
That happened?
Yeah. 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 That was pretty wild. Yeah. Yeah, moments like that, you know, you don't, you, if without being in the industry and you know, and paying respect to these fellas, you don't get the chance to do something like that, you know. And
yeah, they were bloody heroes.
Oh my God, you know, they set the bar, you know, back in the day, and you know, Ryan's Fancy and you know, the Sons of Aaron and all these guys, and on my side, fellas like Bud Davidge, and you know, for me, you know, I'm having my childhood hero on stage with me now, and with Bud Davidge, you know, getting up and playing the accordion, and you know,
I know, it's you brought him out. You actually brought him out.
Yeah, we, you know, we met Bud. I had called Bud back when the when O'Brien's Music was in a bit of trouble. We had the fundraiser, and I asked Bud if he'd come and sing on the show with us, and him and Vince Coles came up and played, right? And
old school.
Old school,
you,
old school.
You are old school. You weren't Ryan's Fancy and Sons of Aaron. You are Bud Davidge and Vince Coles,
right? And, you know, fellas like Bud, you know, Bugsy Green and all these guys, you know.
Play it, Bugs.
Barney's real. Play her, Bugs. Yeah, and became friends with Bugs and stuff over the years, too. And but like I say, you know, to be able to, you know, myself and Chris, you know, said to Bud, you know, we want to record Music and Friends on our next album at the time. And, you know, he was, yes, no problem. And then, we were in the studio, and he was like, we should get Bud and come in and sing on it with us. And sure enough, you know, we called Bud, and he said, yes, be all over it. And then the next thing you know, he's jumping in the car and driving around doing gigs with us around Newfoundland, and then came on the cruise down south. And, you know, did you ever think you'd be, you know, singing Newfoundland songs in Jamaica with Bud Davidge, right?
Well, I mean,
and Fergus O'Byrne, and right?
Bud and Sim, I mean, kind of like you and Chris.
Yep, very similar, yeah.
In terms of two people who
we wish
sort
we could
of
write songs like Bud Davidge does.
Yeah, don't we all?
Right?
But two people who spent their entire life together. They only played weekends.
That's all. Yeah.
They worked Monday to Friday and then sort of jumped in the van on Friday night.
Yeah. We took Bud with us to Labrador last year, and the first time he's ever been. In all the years Sam and I were playing, they never got over to Labrador. So, you know, it was a great great thing for him, too, to be able to get up into Labrador and play a few tunes. And, you know, again, like I say, you know, to be able to have Bud play with us at certain shows, it's been a great privilege for me and I know Chris, too.
I've had Bud in this studio for 30 minutes of time, mm-hmm. and
to sit down and talk to that man.
I know.
Right?
I know.
Yeah, we were down in Chris's basement. We just done a Christmas
wood stove fired up?
Wood stove fired up, right? And, you know, and we were recording a new Christmas. We were recording a new Christmas solo that we're going to be releasing now in the next couple of weeks. And we had Bud come in and sing a verse on it with us. And we sat down and just chatting with him about how, you know, him and Sim done the recording and production down on the South Coast. You know, Sim ran the recording studio and Bud done the manufacturing. And just the whole process from back in the day and right up to the CDs and stuff, right?
I know. It's like, it's amazing. They were like, they actually built the industry because someone could call Bud and order 50.
Yeah, yeah.
Cassettes.
Yeah, that's right.
And they would make 50 cassettes.
Yeah, and send it off to him, right? But yeah, so, and a lot of times, like I say, Sim would record it and then send the master down to Bud. And Bud, and he had the little factory set up there and done all the manufacturing there right on spot. So within probably a week, you could walk out of the South Coast with your product in your hand.
And that's where all the music came from.
A lot of stuff like was recorded.
All your fans.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All the people that sort of made you the musician you were today is a result of what they were doing down there on the South Coast.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there were so many acts and artists and stuff that got their products recorded down there. And they gave a lot of people their start as well down, you know, with people going down there. Right? Yeah. Yeah, it's been quite the run, you know, 25 years. It doesn't seem like, sometimes it doesn't seem like a long time, and other times it seems like a lifetime.
It's a generation plus,
Mark.
And,
you know, myself and Chris are still, you know, we're into it 150%, and, you know, a lot of people think after 25 years you're ready to slow her down, but there's no talks of slowing this thing down yet. The engines are still hot.
Now, listen, Chris is not here, so let's talk about him.
What can we say? You got an extra half hour or what?
Yes, I do, actually.
Come on.
If you want to start talking about Chris, come on. Give us some scoop.
And you've known Chris longer than I have, growing up in beautiful Outer Cove.
I love him.
Middle Cove, Logie Bay, and all right?
He learned to sing.
In your basement.
No, but Chris really learned to sing. He learned to have a voice. He didn't have it when he was young.
I've heard that before, and he'll tell you the same thing. Chris should probably tell you the story himself, but he always talks about Redcliffe, when they had the band Redcliffe.
Yes.
And it's pretty funny. They went down to Ralph, and they wanted to play at Aaron's. Handed Ralph over the cassette. Ralph put it in. I wouldn't do that to the customers. And I was like, oh my. That's one of the funniest stories I ever heard Chris tell. And Redcliffe, of course, was Patrick Moran, Chris, and Jason Whalen.
Which is a pretty strong band, if you ask me.
You know, where the three of those guys ended up. You know, Paddy Moran, one of the most sought-after fiddle players, and with the Irish Descendants, and Jason doing some amazing stuff with his recording studio and with the Punters, and, you know, wicked musician, great singer. And, you know, Chris is, you know, with myself, and we're flat out. So, you know, just that band alone, where three other bands came from just out of that one little band back in the 1990s or early 80s or whatever it was.
I'm talking about Mark Hiscock. We're talking musical history here in the province, and I'm learning tons. You guys have a Christmas concert coming up. It is the extravaganza that happens every single year.
Every single year, December 27th. Yeah, I don't know exactly how many years.
We used to do that.
Yeah,
you know that.
We took it over from you.
Yeah, I know you did. You robbed it. You totally
robbed it. Yeah, we're good. We're good at that. and we'll take full. We'll never deny it. You know, you guys had a great run at it, and. You know, when Great Big Sea stopped doing it, we gladly took it over and ran with it ever since, and it's been a great success, and every year she sells out, and another great year coming up this year on the December 27th. Tickets are out at the Mile One Center, so you can go online or you can go down to the box office and get your tickets. I would assume they're going pretty good right now. They've been out for a few days, so they're. You know, great, great Christmas gift for anybody that wants a little stocking stuffer.
It's become a sort of a chance to get together with old friends, really. That's
what it's turned out to be. You know, yep. A lot of people are coming home for Christmas and, you know, where are we going to meet up? Well, let's meet up on the 27th at the Delta, right? And see Shanaganok and, you know, whatever X are playing at the same time. And, you know, it's a great show, great venue, and like I say, we've had some great success with it, and it's still going strong.
Mark Hiscock from Shanaganok, I'm so glad you came in.
Oh, my God, my pleasure.
And so glad we had a chance to sit down and chat for 30-odd minutes about that band.
Yeah.
Like speaking four-eyed, eye to eye.
Yeah, that's right.
And talking about just what an impact that you guys have had on the traditional music industry in this province.
Yeah, well, you know, we're trying our best to keep the tradition alive, and, you know, myself teaching accordion now, teaching young kids how to play the accordion and keeping it alive on that side as well. And but, you know, the band, you know, usually you get some younger acts that are coming up, and we'll try and, you know, help them out the best we can. Like, you know, they've been on the go now for a while, but Rum Ragged, you know, we've taken them under our wing a few times and taken them on tour with us, and you know, stuff like that. You know, we tried to do our best to help out. We like to help out.
Aaron Collis could teach you a few tricks on accordion.
Aaron is one of the most amazing accordion players. I remember meeting Aaron back when he was just a young boy out around Gander. And, you know, he was a great little accordion player then, but he's after he's amazing, and he's doing the same thing I'm doing now too, teaching young kids the trick. You know, the two of us are out at Music Immersion and
push pull.
Right? Yeah.
Right?
That's it. That's all it is. That's right. Push and pull.
The 7th to the 8th is a tricky one.
Well, you know, to get in the harmonies going, right? The harmony notes.
Mark Hiscock, what a pleasure to chat with you, man.
Daryl, I appreciate it very much, buddy. You got a great show going on here, and it's awesome what you're doing for local entertainers to come on here and be able to promote themselves and keep it up. It's a great show.
You made my day. We're going to the break. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with William Malone. Who is William Malone? He has written the brilliant book, Cops in Kabul. Yeah. The RCMP made a deliberate journey to make sure that people in Kabul would have policing. They were there to teach. What a journey. A journey I don't think I would really be willing to make, but we're going to talk about that when we come back. Don't go away.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
Welcome back to Sunday Drive. This is Daryl Power. Imagine you are 64 years old. You are nearing the end of your work. But you decide to do something that is actually pretty unbelievable. William C. Malone. I've spoken to him before, and I'm about to speak to him again. He is the flanker press writer of Cops in Kabul. He went over to try and put the pieces back together. A Newfoundland peacekeeper in Afghanistan. He is on the line. Mr. Malone, how are you?
I'm good, Daryl. Nice to be back with you again.
I loved your book.
Thank you.
I loved it the first time. I loved it the second time.
Oh.
At 64, most people are thinking about sailing off into the sunset. You didn't.
Well, just to correct you for a second, Daryl, I'm 54.
Oh, my God. Zach, can you actually count that as the first mistake of the day? It took 40 minutes to make the first mistake? Okay. Okay. Sorry. Me and Zach keep account of my mistakes. That's the way we roll here. what made you decide to go there?
So throughout the course of my career in the RCMP, I had the opportunity to do a fair bit of international work. And it's very different from, working within the confines of Canada, in that when you're on the international stage, you're dealing with, fairly significant issues. Not that you're not dealing with significant issues at home, but it's a different aspect of policing. And once I started doing that, my first opportunity was working in a Fredericton drug section in New Brunswick years ago, and having the opportunity to go work in Mexico and Belize. And upon returning from there, for me, working internationally had a sense of intrigue, and it's something that I wanted to do more of. So throughout the course of my lifetime, I've had the opportunity to work in places like Haiti on a UN mission there back in the mid-90s. And then when this opportunity presented itself in 2011, I decided that I wanted to give it a shot.
You were teaching police to police.
Yeah, I myself and about 50 of my policing colleagues from right across Canada, and our contingent was made up of policing agencies right across Canada. It wasn't just RCMP. We had people from Halifax, from the OPP, Toronto Metro, Calgary, Vancouver, and that was the case throughout the 11-year mission. At different times, police officers from right across this country, as a matter of fact, almost 300 of which served in Afghanistan. I've noted them actually in one of the appendices of my book, just to pay tribute to their contribution of the work that they did over there.
It was the Canadians went over there and fought in that conquest and the war, and it was a time of transition. So it was really must have been an interesting time for you for to take the opportunity instead of war to teach people to, you know, keep a level of discretion.
Well, the primary goals when we went over there were to focus on more of the soft skills and the investigative skills, like leadership and management training, specialized policing skills. So helping investigators develop key skills for investigating drug crimes, anti-corruption, organized crime. And we were also helping the Ministry of Interior, which was essentially the Afghan version of public safety, tried to develop and put the right governance structures in place to help them deliver policing throughout the country of Afghanistan, which wasn't easy because given the structure of Afghanistan and the provincial governors, and I make reference to this in my book, in that it's the influence of Kabul and the federal government that they had in place under Hamid Karzai at the time, they didn't exert a great deal of influence outside of the city of Kabul. As a matter of fact, they used to refer to Karzai as the mayor of Kabul. So there was a lot of challenges, particularly on the corruption side, which, you know, it undermines everyone's efforts to try and bring about change in an environment like that.
It's a tough slog to try and bring about change in an environment like that.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is.
But you did. Like, for, you know what? I want to actually take a second and talk about Afghanistan, because it is a place that I so want to go to. The landscape is so beautiful. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it's a pretty rugged and beautiful country. I mean, as you fly over it, you see just how rugged the landscape is. I mean, it's in the northern part of the country. It's very mountainous, the Hindu Kush Mountains, which extend into Pakistan. And then the further you go south, it's more of a desert. And but it really is a very picturesque country. And the unfortunate part is that for far too many years, extending up to current day, I mean, they're still dealing with issues of terrorism, insurgencies, and the sad thing is that the people of Afghanistan have become used to war and have become very battle-hardened, you know, which is sad, really.
I'm grateful to be living here, tell the truth. You know what I mean? I really am. Like, every single week, I find one single moment to let everybody listening know how grateful I am to be living here. I am speaking with William Malone. He is the author of Cops in Kabul. We are going to go to the break, and we're going to continue this conversation because I think we need to make this one go on a little longer. Don't go away. Back in a flash.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
Welcome back to Sunday Drive. This is Daryl Power. I'm talking with William Malone, and we're talking about the book from Flanker Press, Cops in Kabul. William, what was it? I mean, let's talk about where you came from, first of all. You were born in?
I was born in Buckins, and that's where my mom and dad met, and after a short stint there, we moved briefly to Toronto, and then my dad decided to come back to St. John's, So we moved back to St. John's. But, you know, I was very young when all of that happened. And when I was about 5 or 6 years old, we moved to Mount Pearl, which is where I grew up.
Well, can we get a shout out to Mount Pearl? Can we get a little tiny shout out to Mount Pearl, William?
It's a great place.
It is a great place
to grow up.
I love the Pearl. Like, I do love the Pearl. But let's talk about, like, what a change in life it was for you. Let's talk about temperature.
Well, in terms of the temperature in Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's people, when they see pictures of Afghanistan, they generally think it's just desert and hot temperatures. And there is a lot of that. But in Kabul, which is about 1,800 meters above sea level, in the middle of the winter, we used to get a fair bit of snow. So it was quite interesting when we used to get those snow days to be out in traffic and watch many of the locals trying to navigate their way through snow-filled streets with no snow tires or every mode of transportation imaginable. Trying to get around. But yeah, there was, you know, they experienced extreme cold and temperatures in the 40s and sometimes in the south, upwards of 50 degrees.
Amazing. Let's talk about living conditions, because you guys weren't living, I mean, you were the assistant commander over there, and you were not living high off the hog.
No, the living conditions there were Spartan at best. The vast number of our folks were living on military bases. I myself was living in the housing complex at the embassy. All of the amenities that we would have here certainly weren't available to us when we were there.
Why did you think it was so important for you to go there?
Well, you know, I've been asked that question before, and there's, you know, there's various camps who will argue one way or the other that it was a waste of time or that it was worth going there. And
I'm getting to that.
Yeah. So after 9/11, you know, when it was established that the epicenter for the group that was responsible for this, Al-Qaeda, was in Afghanistan. You know, I was working in New Brunswick at the time and ended up moving to Ottawa to work in counterterrorism. And my view was that our law enforcement brothers and sisters in Afghanistan needed assistance in helping build their capacity to fight this at home, because if we don't go there to help them, those issues will come visit us here in North America, as we saw on 9/11.
Mm. Do you think you helped, William?
I think in the time that we were there, I think we, you know, progress in Afghanistan is measured in small increments. And I think that we did a lot of good there. We certainly would not have been able to do that without the assistance of the Canadian Armed Forces. Those people are absolutely amazing, and I can't say enough good about them. I mean, without the security envelope provided by them and our NATO allies, we would never have been able to do what we did.
It was not only a Canadian mission, it was a global mission.
Correct. Yes, it was a NATO mission, and there was, I believe, upwards of 20 countries represented there. You know, the biggest contingent, of course, coming from the United States, Britain, Canada had a significant presence there, as well as Australia, New Zealand, and other countries as well. But, you know, just talking about Canada and Newfoundland in particular, we bat way above our weight when it comes to our international obligations. And I can tell you, you know, the Canadian forces did a lot of great work there. I met countless Newfoundlanders over there. As a matter of fact, I'll just tell you a quick story. There was a change in command of the Canadian battalion in at Camp Phoenix in Kabul. And myself and the commander went over to meet the new colonel and the new regimental sergeant major coming in. And as we were, you know, exchanging greetings and so forth, I noticed a little bit of a Newfoundland twang in the regimental sergeant major's voice.
Really?
I looked at him and I said, "What part of the island are you from?" And he said, "Oh, it's a small place." He said, "You probably haven't heard of it." And I said, "Try me." He said, "Pooch Cove." And I said, "Pooch Cove?" I said, "I know it well." I said, "Do you know any Sullivans in Pooch Cove?" And he said, "I know them all." And I said, "Well, John is my uncle." And he said, turned out he knew my uncle very well and his entire family. So, you know, it really is, as they say, a global village.
Loves me some Pooch Cove. Can we take a minute here, 30 seconds here, and give a shout out to the people from Pooch Cove?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a great experience.
So, William, look, what is your next? You've written this beautiful book, and let me tell you, like, most people just write books, but you totally went the extra step and made a lot of footnotes on the bottom about cases that have been opened, cases that have been closed. You did a lot of work. You have a huge index in the back. Like, you put a lot of work into this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from start to finish, and I guess full disclosure, when I came out of Afghanistan, I really didn't have any intention of writing a book. But when I got home, I was actually quite surprised at the number of people who didn't know anything about the Canadian police mission to Afghanistan. So, you know, lots of people knew about the military contribution and... listen, you know, the military deserve every bit of credit and all the kudos that come their way. They did an amazing job there at a significant price. However, I did think it's kind of sad that nobody knows anything about the police mission. So I started to bring my notes together and just started writing. And from start to finish, it was probably about a 6-year endeavor. Before it was actually published. And, you know, I want to thank Flanker for taking a chance and giving me the opportunity to put it out there, because it was more about the historical record and, you know, and trying to fill in that 11-year gap of policing stories, because, you know, from 2003 to 2014, there were Canadian police officers on the ground embedded in the military doing their thing over there. So, you know, I've actually gone out to a number of my former colleagues and said to them, you know, boys and girls, start putting pen to paper and start, you know, talking about your experiences there. Because in my view, I think it's an important part of history that needs to be told.
William, it is. It was the transition between the Army being in Afghanistan to the RCMP and various police forces teaching the people of Afghanistan how to rule the country, how to run the country.
Well, you know, it's without the rule of law, I mean, it makes things extremely difficult no matter where you are in the world. And when our contingent arrived there in late May, early June of 2011, it was right at that time that the Prime Minister of the day, Stephen Harper, decided that the combat role for Canadian troops was going to end. So at that point, there was a transition of all of the Canadian military and Canadian police officers out of Kandahar into Kabul and points further north. So that's where... You know, we didn't have people going out on presence patrols like our police officers were doing down in Kandahar anymore. We were working out of military camps, going to various facilities in and around Kabul and further north in Mazar-i-Sharif and Faizabad, and working directly with our NATO partners, policing partners, as well as the Afghans.
I've had two absolutely wonderful conversations for the first hour of Sunday Drive. William Malone, I'm so glad you did what you did. You didn't have to do it, but
no.
You did it. And I'm sure you opened up your mind to just what it is like in another part of the world. Thank you for this. I look forward to your next book.
All right. Thank you, Daryl. I really appreciate you, the opportunity to speak with you today.
Take care. The next time you're in town, right?
I am, yes.
My God, yeah. Let's have a coffee.
Sounds good, my friend.
Okay, buddy. Great to talk with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
The book is Cops in Kabul. It is a Newfoundland peacekeeper in Afghanistan. It is William C. Malone. And the first caller who bangs out a call to this office will get a copy of that book. And it's a great one. We're going to the news. Don't go away. Back in a flash.
This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
Welcome back to Sunday Drive. This is Daryl Power. My next guest is one of my favorite Newfoundland singer-songwriters that many people have not heard of because she doesn't live here. She is a touring dog. And right now, today, this weekend, she's back in town. Town, and I say that, I don't say town, I say town, because that's where she is. She's playing a show at the LSPU Hall tonight, and she is on line two, and she's right here with us right now. Kelly, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm great. Kelly, where do you live?
I live in Toronto now.
And you travel...
Hello?
Hello. You travel, like, everywhere.
Yeah, pretty much. This is Kelly Loader, by the way. Hey, everybody.
did I call you?
Are we live?
Oh, we're live, girl.
We're live, aren't we?
We are live. Like, seriously, fake fart sounds will come out on the ear if you actually want them to come out in the ear.
How's it going, Daryl?
I'm doing great, Kelly. Saw your show the last time you were here, and I was absolutely gobsmacked at what you do. So how often do you come back to this town?
I come back quite a bit, but I only do usually just do one show a year. This year we had to do two because last night sold out, and now we got... another show tonight at the hall. I'm pretty excited. I'm currently, I just picked up a new outfit and I'm like wearing it right now. I just tried it on for the first time and I'm staring in the mirror at it.
Oh, outfit? Come on, let's talk about the outfit.
Well, it's pretty interesting. It's, I wanted to try some new things. So I've got these, it's like black pants and it's got like these bronze dots all over them.
Mm-hmm.
Polka dot bronze, and then I've got this like sequin shirt, like a paisley sequin, and it's kind of cool. It's shiny, and yeah.
I saw some pictures last night of the show.
Yeah.
Why does Tybert not get a rug? Like,
we had a rug for him.
What is it about bass players? What is it about bass players? They do not get the respect they deserve, Kelly.
It made the stage look unbalanced because we had two rugs to the left or to the right, and then none on the left. So we had to take out one of the rugs. So
it's a nice place to play.
Why does Tyber not get a rug?
Tyber is going to love this. You know that, right?
He is. Yeah.
It was. How was the show last night?
It was awesome. Yeah, it was packed. It was, it's supportive, and it was just like I was in a big living room playing to some friends, and they were, it was a lot of dialogue, there was a lot of, requesting and cheering, and I would share a story, and then they want to know more, so they would ask questions, and it was really cool. And I'm really excited to be able to do it again tonight. So
you're saying that you were given the show last night and people were asking questions you were answering?
Oh yeah, like it was like a big hang. it was cool. Especially during the acoustic stuff. When the band, left the stage. It was really intimate. It was nice. It was really cool.
Kelly, you are a great singer and songwriter, but a lot of people really don't know who the hell you are.
Why is that?
I don't know. Probably because you're not playing the black sheep every week. You're not playing the black sheep every week.
No. You're coming tonight, though, aren't you?
Oh, yes. I'm coming tonight.
Yeah, I heard you're coming tonight.
So tell me about, where do you play, where do you tour normally?
Even in Toronto, I try not to play too many times in a year, maybe twice a year in Toronto. And I've done a lot of the festivals in the East Coast of Canada. I did a U.S. tour this summer. So it's just a bunch of scattered dates. And I songwrite a lot too. I songwrite with other people and for other projects. I love coming home to do a home show in St. John, the best show of the year.
What's it like to do that?
It's amazing. It's just like you're coming home to your family. You get to show them new songs, and it makes them really excited. Yeah, it's a great time.
Kelly, the decision to leave Newfoundland to travel to Toronto to become a professional musician is a tough one. Not many people do it. You did.
Well, I don't think you really need to travel to Toronto to become a professional musician. That's not necessary. I think it's just different doors that open, different roads you can take when it comes to your opportunities in music. And I just wanted to expand my I guess horizons, or however people say that.
So what doors have opened for you?
I've got to know different people in the industry, people that have booked me for things that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten if I stayed in St. John's. And different crowds you get to play in front of. It's the ultimate goal to get in front of as many people as you can. And that's why I did it.
You're from Gander?
No, I'm from Badger.
Badger. Are your parents coming in to see the show?
They were here last night and they're here again tonight.
Are they?
Yeah.
Then maybe I can get to meet them.
Yeah, you could totally meet them tonight. Mom's always on the merch table, so...
Where's she sitting?
She's not hard to miss.
She's on the merch table?
Yeah.
Oh, I will be finding her. this music industry is a tough industry, Kelly. And I really like talking to you every time you come home because... I know how tough it is, and I know that how few people have the smarts to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough, but everything's tough, isn't it?
It is.
I think it's easier for me to be doing this than something I really would want to do.
How long are you in town for?
I'm not sure. Initially, I was supposed to be here until Tuesday, but I might change my ticket because I really don't want to leave yet.
Jeez, can we write a song?
Maybe. Yeah, if there's time, why not?
3 hours? Can you carve 3 hours out of your schedule?
Maybe we can chat after our live radio interview.
We're live. We are live, and that's the way we roll. And the LSPU is really such a beautiful venue to see a show.
Yeah, it's great. Awesome last night.
Me and my sister are going. Can't wait because who have I seen on that stage? Roger, Dennis, Ron, Kelly.
You haven't seen her yet. See her tonight, though.
It's a really great place to see a show, and I can't wait to see yours tonight. Are there still tickets available?
Yeah, I just got word that there are some available. Maybe 30. I'm not sure. We sold out last night, so like if we sell out tonight, I'm probably just gonna have a heart attack.
I would advise anyone in the St. John's downtown area or Avalon, even if you are on the other side of the isthmus. And I think I've mentioned isthmus twice in one show, which might be a first, to go see your show. Kelly, you're a great singer, you're a great songwriter, and I so enjoy listening to your show, and I'm going to be doing it tonight.
Yeah, I'm excited for you to hear some new tunes.
New tunes?
New tunes. We got a whole set of new tunes.
Are you serious, girl?
Yeah.
Yes! Bring that on, Kelly Loader. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
You're awesome. Take care, girl. Bye-bye. Going to the break, back in a flash.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
Welcome back to Sunday Drive. This is Daryl Power. My next guest is from Bell Island. Have you ever even bothered to take the ferry to Bell Island and see how beautiful it is? Have you ever had the wonderful opportunity to like jump on a boat from CBS and see the Bell from the sea? It is a beautiful, beautiful piece of the country. Teresita McCarthy is on the line. She is the executive director for the Bell Island Heritage Society, and they are having a celebration.
Teresita. Daryl, I think we're going to have to hire you to do some marketing for us. That was absolutely beautiful. If that doesn't get a boatload of people over to Bell Island, I don't know what will.
Teresita, like that view of the Bell from a boat
is remarkable, isn't it?
It is. And I had a young guy who is he's a rock climber. He climbed it. He climbed it. I watched him
really?
Climb it.
Wow.
Yep.
He's a bit nervier than me.
A bit nervier than me, too.
Yes, absolutely.
It is a beautiful corner of the earth. What is going on now in Bell Island?
Well, you know, as you said earlier, I am with the Bell Island Heritage Society, which is the governing body of the No. 2 Mine Tour and Museum on beautiful Bell Island. And we have a season coming up in 2020 that will be exciting and will bring rejuvenation to the community. And we are so happy that we are able to do so many different things that the people will be enjoying, not only locally, but the come from a ways as well.
I'm sorry, I got to be honest, I have not done the mine tour.
Well, if you were sitting with me now, the first thing you'd get would be a little tap on the hand, and that would say to you, you know what, you should be ashamed to say so.
I know.
But in the meantime, there's always a way to rectify that, and if you wanted to kind of make amends and do your penance in 2020... I tell you, there's so many things going on that you'd be more than delighted to be a part of.
Listen, I'm telling you right now, I promise you, I will be doing that tour between June 1st to September 30th, 2020. It's like something I need to do.
Absolutely.
It's a part of our history.
We've got this year, 2020, we are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Belle-Anne Heritage Society, Inc. And along with that, we're also celebrating the 25th anniversary of the first opening of the first museum ever on Belle Island. And in July of 1995, the then Lieutenant Governor Fred Russell, along with the late MHA Steve Neri, our native son, and our native girl, Kay Coxworthy, who were co-chairs of the board at the time, they cut the ribbon to open the first museum. We quickly grew out of that museum, Daryl, and then 20 years later, five years later, which is 20 years ago, we opened the current number 2 Mine Tour and Museum.
You're giving me a bit of a history lesson. You're tossing out a couple of names that I have not heard in a long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am so honored to be able to mention Steve Neri,
mm-hmm.
A. Coxworthy, Lieutenant Governor Fred Russell. They were such big supporters of us when we started in 1995. And the reason why we started then was that was the 100th anniversary of the beginning of mining on Belle Island. And guess what, Daryl? This summer, we'll be celebrating the quasicentennial anniversary of the beginning of mining on Belle Island, which is 125 years. So we will be doing that this summer as well. We'll be opening a brand new Harry Hibbs exhibit.
Mm.
We'll be having a quasicentennial gala. We're going to be having our regular stuff like Remember Our Miners Day. We're going to be having Christmas in the Mines. We're going to be having our fifth annual candle lighting vigil, which is, it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. We started it 5 years ago, which was the 50th anniversary of the closing of the mine. And it's held the final Friday of every June. And the 107 men who died in the mine are named. And the staff, the current people who work in the mine, which is the tour guides and the staff at our museum, they actually read the names. And one of our board members, Tom Spracklin, rings a bell, tolls a bell for each name. And then one of our tour guides, Bonnie Spracklin, last year sang Rita McNeil's song she sings about the miner song.
Yep.
And we put it on, it was put on Facebook, and I think it had something like 13,000 shares or whatever. So it is an incredible, incredible ceremony, very moving, but very fitting as a thank you and a tribute to the 107 men who lost their lives. Also, we're going to have this summer Read by the Sea at Lance Cove Beach. We're going to have Mining Our Matters, which is a Red Hat Society event. We're also going in May, this year actually, in 2019, we started to be very aware of our opportunity to make a difference with regards to climate change. And we made a concerted effort to lessen our carbon footprint with the intention to be totally green by 2020. So in May of 2020, we will be totally green. We'll be having paper packaging, paper straws, paper plates, paper cups, whatever it is that we can basically have that's biodegradable, we will be using at the Museum and Mine Tour. So we're always aware of trying to make not only our community better, but our province better, our country better, and our planet better. And I think it's fair to say that we're moving along in leaps and bounds.
Teresita, thank you for all that you give. And I have a buddy, Pierre Neri, who is Steve's son. So I am going to take an opportunity right now to give a shout out to his dad, Steve, for what he has done. I don't know, Pierre, maybe he's listening, maybe he's not, but Pierre, you're getting the shout out, so is your dad. Teresita, before...
Thank you so much for that, Daryl. That means so much.
Yes, we're all connected, Teresita. We are all
Absolutely.
Connected.
Absolutely, I don't doubt it for a
right?
minute.
Right? That's especially in this province. It's amazing. Every single week, I'm reminded how we are all connected. Teresita, before I let you go, let's talk about Radio Bell Island.
Okay.
Because it looks like Kiwanis has taken over the contract.
Well, no. Kiwanis has, to my knowledge, obviously I'm not a member of Kiwanis. And nor am I a member of Radio Bell Island. Having said that, I don't believe that Kiwanis has taken over a contract from Radio Bell Island, but I do believe that Kiwanis has managed to secure the Radio Bell Bingo license. So now the Kiwanis will be operating the Bell Island Bingo rather than the radio station.
What do you think of that?
Well, I'm all about growth in this community. I think it's probably very obvious from the short conversation that we've just had that moving Bell Island ahead is something that I personally like to see happen. Not only do I like to see it happen, I like to contribute to making it happen. Therefore, if Kiwanis getting the bingo license in any way helps to assist Bell Island in moving ahead, I'm all for it, Daryl.
Me too. What have you heard any rumors that Radio Bell Island may be sort of looking for a cut of the pie and not willing to broadcast bingo on the island?
I never deal in rumors, Daryl. If I don't have the facts, I normally don't speak to it. So while I may have an opinion, I don't think it would be very wise of me to be sharing my opinion with anybody, because it would be simply that. It would be an opinion. I would hope, though, I would sincerely hope that community radio would be supporting any entity that would be having the bingo license, because once again, I'll go back to my original statement that moving Bell Island ahead should be, it certainly is my priority, but from the people that I deal with and many of the people in the community, it is everybody's priority to bring Bell Island to a better place than it is today. So if that bingo license helps do that in any way, I would certainly hope that the radio station, which is a community radio, would also be working hand-in-hand with Kiwanis to move things ahead.
Teresita, the things you do for your island, I commend. And I really hope that you keep it up. It's been a
Thank
great
you.
Conversation. For the, it really has been. Let's keep in touch, okay?
Absolutely. And I'm going to hold you to your original statement that you're going to come visit us this summer. And if I can get a hold of your email address, Daryl, I can send you a calendar of events. And then maybe you might want to take in some of the special events as well.
I got your number now, girl. I am going to be like I'm going to be trolling you on like that's it. I'm like
Perfect.
Officially going to be trolling you every day on the official Twitter box or the official messenger or whatever.
Perfect.
Else that we need
you
to do.
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find a museum on Facebook. You can find a museum on Twitter. And listen, I couldn't be trolled by a better person. Thank you so much.
Teresita, you're awesome. Thanks for this.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Back in a flash.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Bigland FM radio network.
Welcome back to the show. This is Daryl Power. This is Sunday Drive. And my next guest is Joshua Jameson. Jameson, let's take a minute, folks. Take a second. Does that name ring a bell with you? Can we talk about Don Jameson? Can we talk about that Christmas album that we all grew up listening to? Joshua is on the line. We have lots to talk about. Here he is in line two. Joshua, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on this afternoon.
Your dad was a great guy.
Yeah, he was my grandfather, actually. So, and I grew up, I've had the wonderful pleasure of growing up. And any opportunity or any moment that somebody finds out that I'm a part of that family, so often they end up sharing a personal story with me about when they might have met him for the first time or something that he might have done during his broadcasting career or different ways that he might have helped in various individuals over the course of his political career. I've had the wonderful benefit of being able to grow up hearing all of those stories and having them all come back to me, which is it's so invaluable because he actually passed away when I was 2.5 years old. So my memories of him, my personal memories of him are a little vague, but they are brought to life with such vibrant color thanks to the wonderful memories that people share with me.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but tell me a story.
So a particular story that I like to tell, it was because I heard all of these stories growing up that I ultimately was motivated to produce, direct, and write a film about him, about his life, and the various ways that he contributed to the community for our greater good. And I produced that film in 2012. And one of the stories that didn't make it into the film because we had a wonderful agreement with NTV, who committed to broadcasting the film twice. And that meant that we had to aim for a 44-minute length so it would fit into a one-hour broadcast period. But there is a version of the film that exists that's a couple hours long. And we had to start cutting away stories reluctantly. Hmm. And one of the stories had to do with a 1970s visit of the then Prime Minister Trudeau, Trudeau number one. And he came down to Newfoundland and Labrador to participate in an event that my grandfather organized at the Swift Current family homestead. And it was called the Think-In. And this was held in 1971, 72. And the Prime Minister came down to participate in it. And there were a number of youth that were invited to come to the house, youth who were actively engaged in the community in different ways. And the purpose of that was really for them, for my grandfather and for the Prime Minister and other elected officials at the time, for them to hear from the generation, the future generation. And that resulted in a document called What Kind of Newfoundland Do You Want? And that story is in the film. But what didn't make it into the film was that my grandmother had, she was always the consummate host. And she completely flipped one of the guest rooms for the Prime Minister and his wife to stay in. She bought new drapes, she bought new sheets, she knew everything, new lampshades, the whole nine yards. And she was mortified only to find out the following morning that they had actually gone into the adjacent room and spent the night in that particular one, which is where she had thrown all of the older stuff. So she had put such great efforts into creating this wonderful new space for them to stay in during their time in Swift Current. And unfortunately, they ended up in the wrong room.
She was probably smarter than Don, too. Let's just throw this out right now.
My grandmother was definitely as smart as a whip, as they say, and I've always kind of been brought up to know that behind every good politician is the saying used to be is a strong woman, but that obviously has certainly changed with the time. So there's a strong partner, but Uncle Don, as I call him, Don Hollett, was my grandfather's campaign manager for many years. Eventually, ran in an election himself, and he's in the documentary film as well. And he comments at one point in the film that he would estimate that my grandmother climbed more stage heads and knocked on more doors than my grandfather did at campaign times and even throughout the year, because he would always say that the next campaign starts as soon as Election Day is over, and he tirelessly worked for the people who he represented. At the end of the day, that's all that mattered to him. And that's really, getting the stories out was one reason why I wanted to make that film in 2012. But it was also to really highlight the different caliber of politician that I felt existed back then in the 60s and in the 70s and even in the 80s. There was such a tremendous focus on a politician being dedicated to the constituency and the electorate. And I wanted to reiterate that and reinforce that with the telling of this film.
They were powerhouses. Like, that is, like really, like, I'm old enough to, probably older than you, Joshua, to know what powerhouses they were. Tell me about the event or the scholarship that is occurring now in your grandfather's name.
So, yeah, many people know Don Jameson remembers an old-fashioned St. John's Christmas, a 1979 album that he recorded.
Do I ever. Heard it 100 times.
And, yeah, you know, it gets paraded out every year in so many households throughout the province. And up until recently, it only existed in a vinyl format. There were a few hundred vinyl copies pressed back in 1979 when it was originally released, and that's all that existed in the world. And when I produced the film in 2012, I had a lot of people approaching after the fact, contacting me through the film's website or through my Twitter profile at JJ Moxie, and they would be messaging me asking me if there was any way to get a hold of that recording. So I listen to it every year while I wrap gifts. That's my own tradition. And in 2016, I decided that I would pipe the vinyl player through my laptop and get a good, clean digital recording of it while I listen to it in that particular year. And I scheduled an email to go out to my family members with the audio files attached to it. And I timed that email to go out for Christmas morning of 2016. So it was a Christmas surprise for all of them in their inbox that they would be able to have these digital files. And that's as far as it went. But in the email, I proposed that we all consider as a family the idea of establishing a scholarship, not just in my grandfather's name, but in the name of his and his brother's names. Because, of course, Baz and Colin had very storied careers as broadcasters and as elected officials as well. And we wanted to honor all of their memories. And they actually had a fourth brother named Huey. So we agreed as a result of that email that we would establish the Jameson Family Memorial Scholarship. And we launched that officially, this initiative, in November 2017 in partnership with the Community Foundation of Newfoundland and Labrador. And we're so grateful for that partnership.
Joshua, it is a wonderful idea, the Jameson Scholarship. As someone who is lucky enough to sit in the same chair as Baz, seriously, don't think that this idea is not lost on me. Let's keep in touch. Keep me informed about what this scholarship is all about, and let's see if we can make it grow.
Yeah, so we're trying to raise $42,000. That's our goal, and that will ensure, if we do that, that'll ensure that we're able to issue a $1,500 scholarship every year in perpetuity to any student across the country who is enrolled in a post-secondary institution set to study journalism, communications, or political science. So this Wednesday coming at the Rooms on November 20th, we're screening the documentary film there as part of their Archives Week programming, and we'll have the Christmas CD available there for $20. All sales, all of the proceeds from sales of that Christmas CD, well, no matter where you buy it, because we're in a bunch of stores as well, all of the proceeds from that goes to the scholarship. And you can learn more about the scholarship at jamesonfamilyscholarship.ca. And you can also find more information about the film at justhimself.wordpress.com. or at joshuajameson.com. And I also certainly invite people to follow along and watch our story unfold on Twitter at JJ Moxie.
Thanks for this, Joshua. I I might have to dig in. I gave all my albums to my son. I'm going to have to dig in
you'll
and see if I have a copy of this. I might actually have a copy.
Or you can also download it right away on iTunes. We're on all the digital platforms. So if you're opening your gifts on Christmas morning and you realize you forgot to buy the CD, which we really hope you didn't, you can just download it through iTunes and have a listen on Christmas morning.
Joshua, you're a great guy. Let's keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much. We really appreciate the shout-out on the show today. And we hope to see lots of people at the rooms on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. for the film.
The Jamesons, let's take a minute to appreciate those guys. Thanks for this. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Going to the break, back in the flesh.
Your Sunday drive continues right after this. This is Sunday Drive on the VOCM Midland FM radio network.
Just go with what we got. That's what my producer says, and that's exactly what we're doing. Karen Silver is on the line. Choices for Youth, the great work they're doing. We're going to talk about that right now. Karen, how are you?
Not bad. And yourself?
I'm doing great. What wonderful things are you doing right now?
Well, first of all, I don't actually have any affiliation with Choices for Youth.
Okay.
I kind of took this upon myself last year, and I filled 88 boxes that went to Choices and through Stella Circle. And so this year, my goal now is, I was talking with one of the employees of Choices, and she said that someone who received a box last year, he was recently talking about it, and it was the only gift that he got last year for Christmas, and he loved everything that was inside of it, and it was just so perfect for him. And hearing that made me feel so good, and like, it made me feel good regardless, but knowing that, like, hearing actual feedback that it made somebody's, you know, Christmas that much better. So my goal this year is to fill 50 boxes, because that's roughly the number of people who show up to Christmas or to Choices on Christmas Day itself.
Karen, I'm reaching for my third tissue of this show. Okay? Like, I am totally have no problem being vulnerable with people who are doing great things. This is a great thing.
I got inspiration from a project. It was called the Shoebox Project, and it was a great idea, but it was only for women. And I understand that, you know, a lot of women or a lot of people in shelters are women, but everybody deserves something at Christmas. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, men, women, gender non-binary people, anybody who is in a vulnerable situation at Christmas is able to get something, especially youth who are, you know, away from their family, or they don't have any family, or they've been, like, you know, disowned from their family. I want them to know that, you know, people in the community really care about them.
How can people get a hold of you?
So you can email me at writonnl, WRITE.
Right on.
Yep.
Did you really actually manage to scam right on?
Yeah.
I love that. Like, my God, I would have thought that would be, like, robbed, like, 10 years ago. Right on.
Yeah, you think so, right? Yeah, so it's at Outlook.com. Yeah, I started doing writing classes last year for youth, and so that's what I called it, Right On and No.
Right on. You know, I spoke to someone a couple of weeks ago who was actually filling purses for women. It's it's not the big things that make you know, that mean so much to people. It's the small things, the toiletries, the toothpaste, the toothbrushes. It's like we can do a lot of work and help a lot of people for a very small amount of money.
Oh, for sure. Exactly. And the New York Kids, it's 207 Chemout Road. It's up behind Chess's and in front of Hayward's Furniture. So they're a drop-off point, and if anybody wants to drop things off there, they're more than welcome to. And it's a great indoor playground for kids as well, so there's just tons of fun. So if people want to drop things off there, they can also drop off cash or gift cards or anything like that, or you can send me an EMT or contact me in order to, arrange a pickup. But I will, you know, if you want to pick up some tubes of toothpaste or something like that, that's great. But if you don't have time and you want to send some money or, you know, get me to come pick up a gift card, I can definitely do that as well.
Karen Silver, I'm... it's the first time I've done this today, and I'm like, you are so deserving of this. Keep me in the loop about this project, okay?
Oh, for sure, yeah.
We can talk about it again, I promise.
Yes. Yeah. I'd love to, and maybe I can, I'm trying to organize, like, some kind of, like, a fundraising endeavor, you know, get people to, like, come in and, you know, drop off a bunch of things, so if I can arrange that, and I'll definitely contact you so that we can get the word out there for everybody.
You know how to find me, Daryl Power NL, Daryl Power on Facebook. I mean, I'm pretty easy to find. Karen, I really appreciate the work you're doing. It's great.
Thank you so much. Thank you for talking to me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Have a great night.
And the last call. I don't usually get political. I don't. But every now and then, I like to stand up and have a chat about what's going on in this province. John Shepherd. I have asked John Shepherd to come on the air for probably, I don't know, 600 times. He said no every time. But finally, he's decided to come on the air. You know why? Because we're talking about green crabs. We're talking about green crabs. And I know, folks, you guys are listening, say, Daryl doesn't talk about politics. Daryl talks about good news stuff. But every now and then, I need to talk about the things that mean something to the future of this province. John Shepherd is on the line. John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm not sure if this is politics or not, but it is history.
I really want to thank you for, because I've been begging you to come on for this, that, or the other thing forever. We're talking green crabs. Tell me about the green crab.
Well, they're pretty known throughout Atlantic Canada. Here in Newfoundland, we're not really doing anything about them other than a couple make work projects for a couple friends and people. Nova Scotia, they're fishing them. They're fishing them for the economy and they're fishing them for bait.
They're using them for bait. Why aren't we doing that here, John?
Because the ACAP Humber Arm and not ACAP Exploits Arm. I don't know. I mean, we got two organizations that got basically make work projects out of this, and the problem's only growing. So we got the green crab are pretty much one of the number one environmental issues, real, true environmental issues affecting the Newfoundland and Labrador environment. If they come into your shores, the only thing that's not going to get destroyed by them is an aquaculture fish.
I've seen a map, and they are coming into a lot of shores, John.
Yes. They started here in Steamville, actually.
Did they?
Yeah. They started here in Steamville. That was reported by the Nova Scotia DFO, because the DFO workers here in Newfoundland and Labrador, the only time they look at things that are in plenty of fish is when they're looking for a date.
And somehow they got from Steamville to Placentia Bay.
Well, if you look at it, the way the ferry would go, or the way whatever brought in came, it started here in Steamville. It got to other places, but any place that would have, because here in Sydney were the main two places right off the bat. And that was likely the same boat that brought them in, and then they just kept growing, growing, and growing. And
it's bilgewater. That's where they sort of... Like, that was the start of the green crab in this province.
Yeah. And if you got something in your bay that doesn't really, like, if there's anything getting put extra into the bay, like, here, they were called the strongest strain of green crab anyone's ever seen. Almost impossible to kill.
So.
And same with Placentia, that they got a mine there, don't they? That's where they came from as well.
So, John, It's funny because I saw a tweet earlier this week from DFO, and they were talking about the most unwanted invasive species in the country. So, what are they doing?
Where are you talking about? They're doing quite a lot in Nova Scotia and PEI and New Brunswick.
Why not here?
Because we don't want the zoo.
Why not?
We don't have a fisheries minister. Our fisheries is a social program here. In Nova Scotia, the lobster industry is a $1 billion industry that has people from out west, people that moved out west, moving back home because that's where the money's due.
So why are they so harmful to the lobster industry?
Well, it's the amount of toxins that are inside them. So a lobster is one of the most aggressive shellfish you'll see. If anybody who's ever banded lobster will tell you that by the time you get to the bottom of the barrel, you're going to see about 4 loose claws because they fight each other. Lobsters fight. So they're going to fight this green crab. And there's so many, what the Dalhousie research said, when a lobster fights a green crab, there are so many toxins within the green crab that even if the lobster wins, it loses in the end because it's poisoned.
You know, John, I don't usually take these calls on this show, but sometimes I think it's important enough to actually have these calls on this show. And this is...
Yeah, that's why I was surprised when you asked for this show.
Yeah, I know. This is like an important call that needs to be had. What can we do before I let you go?
We can do what everybody else is doing and fish them for profit. Or there's two options. There's eliminate them altogether, which I'm not for because I don't believe in elimination of a living species. The other option is to manage it. You got numerous lobster fishermen. This is a low-cost fish to fish. Make it part of their bycatch. They can use it as bait. They can use it to sell. They can use it to help farmers out because you can use it as fertilizer. You know, except here in Newfoundland and Labrador, there have been people who have tried to do that research on the farming aspect, but the Department of Agriculture turned them down.
John, I'm glad it only takes me 5 years to get you on the air. You know what I mean? It's like, I do not let people go. I keep bugging them and bugging them and bugging them to get them on the air. I finally got them on the air, and I actually think that the whole province needs to hear what's on your mind, brother.
Oh, I don't know. When I do my contest, they might disagree.
We need to do something about him, John. It's really, really, really a story that needs to be addressed. And I thank you for the last minute of your time, brother.
Yeah, I just want to say that we need to look at the things that are different here, and they're the reason why things are different here. We have a fisheries ministry who thinks the fisheries is a social program. We have a union who thinks that it's best to have everybody together. The only place benefiting from that is St. John's. We are the only province that does these things, and we don't get the best results.
We are going to talk more often, brother. Thanks for this.
No problem, buddy.
Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you have a great day.
You too.
Or you, Zach.
End of show, Sunday Drive. Don, thanks to Zach Snow for helping me out like he always does. I'll be back next Sunday, 22. Let's see. Never mind. I'm not doing the math. I'm not going to bother doing the math. 7 days and 22 hours. Never mind. The math just came to me. Thanks to Zach. Thanks to you for listening. Until we meet each other again, God guard you, Newfoundland and Labrador.